managed to torment me. I came to visit Sam on the set when I had just a few days off the Briscoe shoot. All I wanted to do was hang out behind the monitor with Sam and crack jokes, but he had other ideas. The minute he saw me arrive on set, his face lit up. It wasn't that he was glad to see me, it's just that I represented a solution to his current problem. Sam, hey, come here, you. I'm going to put you in this film. Bruce, oh no, really, Sam. I just want it. Sam, shut up, come here with me. Sam dragged me to the wardrobe trailer and shoved me in. Hey, gals, I want you to make this guy look like a loser, see? Like he used to be rich, but now he's a nobody. Make the clothes dirty and rotting a little bit. When I was done with the impromptu fitting, Sam pushed me into the makeup trailer. Sam, you know, this is great, but Sam, shut up. Mike, make this guy look like a bum, like he's got some horrible disease. Give him a sore on his lip and everything. Bruce, oh, Sam, shut up, it'll be great. See you out there. About a half hour later, an assistant director came to find me. They're ready to shoot with you now, Bruce. Shoot what? Only Sam knew for sure. It turned out he didn't need me to help plug some hole in his plot. He needed me to help him shut an actor up. Pat Hingle, a great character actor for 40 years, had been pestering Sam about why his character never got revenge on the pimp who sold his daughter. Sam never had an answer for him, until I showed up. Sam, okay now, Pat, this guy here is going to come up to your daughter and say, come on, girly girl, you and me are going to do the devil's dance. Bruce, I am? Sam, quiet, mister. So, Pat, you see this happening, and before this horrible guy can do anything else, you jump in there and save your daughter. Pat, well, so I should rough him up a little. Sam, a little? Hell, you'd be pissed. Oh, don't worry about this guy. He's like a stuntman. You can do anything you want to him. I think you should choke him, actually. Pat, well, maybe I could throw an arm around his neck from behind. Sam, yeah, that'd be great. And then you throw him down the street and kick him one last time in the ass. Pat, okay, sounds good, Sam. Bruce, hey, Sam, could I ask a question? Where is my character coming from? Should I come from over there? Sam took this opportunity to humiliate me in front of the entire crew. Sam, oh, so Bruce has questions. Well, maybe we should all just wait while we answer every one to your satisfaction. Bruce, well, Sam, Sam, you'll stand where I tell you to stand, mister. You'll say what I tell you to say. You'll do what I tell you to do. Okay, Sam, whatever. After numerous takes of this rough encounter, Pat Hingle seemed pleased. As he walked away a happy camper, Sam approached me. Sam, hey, thanks for your help, buddy. That scene will never see the light of day. Scott Spiegel was bullied into a role as a scavenger. He, too, suffered the public wrath of Sam. Scott, Sam was so funny as a director, he'd go, okay, let me hear how you're going to do it. It was like in front of everybody. I mean, can't he just pull me off to the side or something? But it was cool. Bruce, didn't you hang out with a guy that nobody knew? Scott, yeah, Russell Crowe. I met him on a van ride to the set. It's 7 in the morning. I'm next to Woody Strode and all these character actors. Bruce, and he fires up a cigarette? Scott, yeah, we're in a closed van, and he's listening to, like, the worst Australian rap music, and I'm like, what are you doing? Bruce, did you bug Leonardo? Scott, well, he was really into what he was doing, but he and that little blonde kid were playing the most childish games. They were playing tag. I'm like, will you get out of here? But I saved a call sheet. It was so cool. Leonardo DiCaprio, Gene Hackman, Sharon Stone, Scott Spiegel. I'm like, oh, my God. Chapter 40, A Madness to My Method. Email. Hello, my name is Joe, and I am a struggling actor trying to make it. I was wondering if you could give me any pointers on getting a career going, or tips on how to get started, or maybe just tips on how to get ladies. Either one will sit just fine with me. Sincerely, Joe. I once heard that Robert De Niro lived with a steelworking family for 6 weeks in order to prep for his role in The Deer Hunter. I've watched interviews with actors who tell wrenching stories of how hard it was to shake a character after filming was complete. You know, that's all well and good, but 99% of the time an actor is lucky to know what scene is being shot. Of course, some films have rehearsals where you can work out blocking and discuss every nuance of your character ad nauseam. Since my first film in 1979, I've rehearsed like this maybe 2 times. Most film projects, and certainly all of TV, simply don't have time for it. In this more realistic world of acting, you have to think fast or you'll get buried. My first TV gig, Knots Landing, left me speechless. The director introduced himself to me in the morning and never said another word to me for the rest of the shoot. As they were setting up my first shot, I realized that I had no props. Here I was playing a businessman at a meeting, and I didn't have a watch, a briefcase, or documents of any kind. I quickly wrangled the prop man and got what I needed. Welcome to TV, I figured. On any given day, projects other than big A pictures are going to shoot between 5 and 8 pages, with or without you. So acting can't always be about method. Often, big dramatic scenes are filmed at inopportune times, under the least dramatic circumstances. The concept of intimate doesn't really apply when there are 30 crew members standing around and you're the only reason they haven't gone to lunch yet. What happens when you have to break down in tears and the sun is about to dip below the horizon? I can guarantee you, that big yellow ball doesn't give a hoot about motivation. What if your big scene falls at the end of a 12-hour day, which always seems to be the case, and you can't even think straight, let alone hit your marks? In situations like that, I say, bring on the fake tears. How soon can I get them? I've often opted for saline drops, or in more extreme cases, menthol crystals to bring on the waterworks. Menthol crystals work best. They're packed into a small plastic tube, and just before you film, the makeup person blows menthol gas directly into your eye. The results are almost immediate, as your eye frantically attempts to ward off this semi-toxic substance. Every time I think of it, I laugh at the notion that Charlie Chaplin, in his heyday, would let shooting grind to a halt for days on end until he came up with a clever idea. In today's environment, he'd be strung up by his thumbs. Actors are renowned for changing dialogue, and I'm sure writers love to hang them in effigy, but sometimes there are good reasons for this. Actors bring a fresh eye to the material after a writer has sometimes lost valuable perspective. No matter what writers say to the contrary, I can tell you that any actor worth their salt will analyze their character just as much as the writer has done. During the rewrite process, an actor's input becomes even more crucial. In many cases, a writer will make changes in plot, tone, and dialogue, usually to suit their employer, and will fail to, quote, track the ripple effect on characters throughout the piece. Granted, actors can also be major bullshit artists. Demands to make dialogue more, quote, organic should be ignored, because it means the actor doesn't really know what they're talking about. More forgiving are demands to make the dialogue suit their personality. I don't buy this 100% because the actor is, after all, hired to play someone who is not them. Sometimes an actor will simply do what they can to reduce the amount of dialogue. I can tell you, expository dialogue is the hardest to memorize because it always includes new names of places and people. Okay, people, listen up. Willie, you and Jenkins take the Ridgeback Road to Blanding Field by 12 o'clock. George, you and Eddie take the X-11 and make sure those simulators get to White City in one piece, or Captain Murdoch will have our asses. In McHale's Navy, Tom Arnold played the leader of a motley crew. It was his job as a character to explain what was going on in almost every scene. To combat this, Tom reassigned lines almost every day. Hey, Bruce, you haven't said anything in a couple of days. Why don't you take this line? Whatever you say, big guy. In some cases, an actor can't change a line of dialogue even if he wanted to. This would be common in either the arena of theater, where a playwright's words are more precious, or in the case of Congo, where the writer obviously had enough clout to enforce it. John Patrick Shanley won an Academy Award for Moonstruck and has written a number of plays, but I would be willing to bet my salary on the film that he had a no-changes clause in his contract, because after the first take of my first scene, the script supervisor came up to me with a worried look.
Excuse me, Bruce, that last take you added an and a well and a huh.
Oh, did I? Okay, what's your point?
We really need to stick to the script.
Exactly? She nodded gravely. I have to tell you, that really pissed me off because when take two came along, all I could think of was, am I getting these lines exactly right, instead of how to best present the idea of the scene. Good Lord, I was just trying to smooth out lumpy transitions. I had no desire to change the intent. Aside from all that, let's not kid ourselves. Congo was adapted from another author's novel, so it wasn't even an original screenplay, let alone some play that opened on Broadway to rave reviews. This was a big schlock summer film. Once you get past the script stuff, you got to lay out your scene in the form of blocking. I enjoy getting the overall sense of a scene before it's broken down into a million shots. Many directors, mostly those suckled on MTV, lean more toward the technical side and don't really know how to talk to actors. One poor sap, thinking he was laying out the blocking, came over to explain a scene. "Okay, the first shot is here. We see you in the doorway, Bruce. Then the second shot comes swooping around to reveal Claire at the window. After that, I got this great shot of you over at the table. You sit and we track into this movie star close-up. Sound good?"
Yeah, if I was the cameraman," I countered. "How did I get to the table and why was I in the doorway? Maybe we should just back up a second."
In rehearsing a scene, I like to block first, just like a play. It sounds so basic and elementary, but it's becoming a lost art. In my first half-dozen films, the concept of blocking wasn't foremost in my mind. It was more like, cool, I'm working on a film. After the goosebumps wore down and I got a better sense of what was going on, it seemed like the basics were being ignored 75% of the time. Any film set, regardless of how fast it's moving, can spare the time to let the actors go through the scene line by line so everyone gets a sense of the movement. Once that's done, I frankly don't give a rat's ass how the director wants to shoot it, or in what order. Now that the actor is happy, what does he bring to the party in exchange? This leads me to the topic of memorization. An actor must decide how well he or she wants to learn the material at hand. The Hudsucker Proxy was a study in contrasting acting styles. Jennifer Jason Leigh showed up the first day of rehearsal and knew every one of her many lines cold. She also made an early decision, right or wrong, to play the role in a very specific way, speech patterns and all, and it was now just a matter of committing it to film. Tim Robbins, on the other hand, liked to warm up. He held the script in his hand through most of the rehearsal process and enjoyed 6 or 7 takes on film to get where he needed to be. I'm not suggesting that either method is best, but they are very different. Becoming intimately familiar with the script can allow an actor to explore other aspects of performance, like tone, pacing, etc. Actors who show up on a film set not knowing their lines, and you would be astounded at the high ratio, have only one hope for the day: get through it the best they can. I was determined to know my lines for the pilot episode of The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. as well as I possibly could. Aside from a great respect for the writing, I wanted to be ready for anything. Deke Anderson, an actor buddy of mine, put me through the paces of memorizing to the point where he could toss out any cue line in the script, and I knew the response. We called this little game Stump the Actor. This preparation allowed me to be more accommodating to the other actors because I wasn't solely concerned with the lines. The downside of over-preparing is that you run the risk of losing quirky elements that make some performances very appealing. On the other hand, a loosey-goosey approach can throw off the rhythm of the other actors. Some actors play the dirty little game of screwing up their lines in every take except their close-ups. It's funny how an actor can bumble about during wide shots and medium shots and then become super focused, alert, and competent when that fat 135mm lens comes out. That's when, as an actor or director, I just want to slap them silly. For me, I don't really live or die for close-ups. I find them too restrictive and technically oriented. By delivering a consistent performance, regardless of the shot, it allows the director to edit freely and assemble the best possible scene. Aside from basic disciplines, there are intangible qualities that actors can embrace or reject. For example, they must ask themselves, "Should I eat lunch with the crew?" This may seem snobbish, but it's an important decision whether to acknowledge the people who support what you do or whether to keep them at arm's length. You'd be surprised how many actors eat by themselves. I've never had a problem mingling, quote, below the line. I figure we're all in the same sinking ship together, and if the shoot is long and hard, I'll take all the friends I can get. Actors must also decide how much they want to know. Should they make the effort to become acutely aware of what every other crew member does and their relationship to it? Or should they just act? Personally, I feel that all actors should attend a filmmaking workshop, because it would give them a far greater appreciation for all the hard work done around them. To me, it works this way. You could give the performance of a lifetime, but if the shot is out of focus because you didn't take the effort to mark out your movements with the focus puller, then you've boned yourself because the take can't be used under any circumstance.
I like to get very familiar with the camera crew and what their needs are. I have on many occasions made deals with the camera operator. Okay, look, I promise not to go any closer than this, and I would demonstrate, and I won't go any further away than this. If an actor really wanted to, he could also make himself familiar with camera lenses and their many uses. Most establishing shots, for example, use a wider angle lens in order to capture the full view of a building or landscape. If the actor is involved in the shot, his range of motion is almost unlimited, like it would be in a play. When it's time for the big close-up, a longer or telephoto lens is often used. It makes the actor look cool and powerful, but it also makes focus and movement far more critical. On top of that, if there's less light available, the depth of field is reduced and the focus puller is more likely to have difficulty keeping the shot sharp. Knowing this, an actor can be a great help to that department. Unwittingly, actors can be their own worst enemies. My wife, Ida, worked with an actor, Eric, who mumbled all of his lines because he loved to redo his performance in post-production. This is problematic on several fronts. Aside from making the sound man your instant enemy, he almost got in fistfights with Eric Daly, you are forcing the other actors to guess when you're done talking. I make it a point to warn the sound team if I'm going to do something unexpected that would either blow their headphones off or cause them to dive for the gain knob. It's really just common sense. If I bone them, I'm going to find myself replacing the dialogue later, dialogue that I might not want to do over again. On a film shoot, an actor spends most of his day waiting around. To pass the time, I've seen them read, run lines, make whoopee in their trailer, smoke crack, sleep, or simply hang out with the other actors, smoking cigarettes and complaining about their agents. In the case of McHale's Navy, it was Tom Arnold's personal mission to see how little time he could spend on the set every day. Granted, the temperatures were blistering, but you didn't see Ernest Borgnine racing back to his trailer after every take. Here was a guy, an Academy Award winner, in his late 70s if he were a day, in full dress uniform, and he never left the set. Ernest would find a piece of shade, remove his hat, and wait patiently until he was needed. Production assistants, concerned for his well-being, constantly hovered about. "Can I get you some water, Mr. Borgnine?" "No, thanks, son," he'd reply politely. "I'm just fine." Ernest represented the old-school mentality of, "Let's quit crapping around and get this sucker in the can." And I really admired it. I think many actors today have learned some awful habits that have nothing to do with their craft. They have studied too long at the pain-in-the-ass university and graduated with honors. How does this start, and where will it end? I worked with a seasoned actor, John Mahoney, who played the father of a big action star. For a dramatic scene, they naturally filmed the star first. When the time came to turn the camera around and film the supporting actor, Mr. Big Shot was nowhere to be found, and this poor fellow had to perform opposite the script supervisor. Now that's class. John, who is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet, also played the part of an evil hospital administrator. The good guy's star, Ray, felt that he had to hate John on and off the set. Every time John came into the makeup trailer, Ray would bolt out the other end, and all efforts at making small talk were rebuffed. Much to John's shock, Ray approached him at the end of the shoot. "John, it was really great working with you," he said, all smiles. "I really wish I could say the same, Ray." In my opinion, there's method acting, and there's just being an asshole. And some actors just can't make the distinction. Chapter 41. Fanalysis. The definition of celebrity. 1. The state of being celebrated. 2. A celebrated person. Why does celebrity fascinate us? What makes us care whether a princess divorces a prince or what the inside of Kevin Costner's home looks like? Personally, I think the answer lies in the perception that celebrities have something we don't, whether it's money, fame, or a seemingly charmed life. I wrote a fan letter to Steve McQueen because I thought he was the coolest guy on earth. He could race cars, put out burning buildings, and get all the beautiful babes. Typically, my letter to him was addressed, "Steve McQueen, Hollywood," and I never got a response. In the case of Princess Diana, I think we found ourselves glued to the divorce proceedings because deep down we still wanted to believe that fairy tales were real. Her death united us in shock and horror because it was a tragedy of Greek proportions. I was in Paris when Princess Di was killed. I was, in fact, out for a leisurely stroll with my agent, Jeff Goldberg, about a mile from the scene of the crash and close to the time of her death. It wasn't until the next day that I found out what had happened, ironically from my wife in the States. Bad news travels fast, I guess. Personally, Diana's death haunted me far more than other celebrities that have recently passed. When Versace was gunned down in Florida, for example, I remember how cold-blooded it was, but were it not for the manhunt and ensuing media frenzy, I'm not sure how much more I would have thought about it. But Princess Di was different. Her death gave me the willies because of the way she died. Maybe it's because, as an actor, I've had cameras jammed in my face by dozens of photographers yelling, "Bruce, Bruce, over here, hey, Bruce!" I've walked the gauntlet at various functions, and even in these controlled environments, it was unnerving. Desperation seemed to permeate the air. After Diana's death, experts debated the topic in every form of media, and we tried to make sense of it all. Many folks blamed the photographers for her death. I'm sure they contributed in their own annoying way, but in the end they were merely errand boys attempting to satisfy demands placed on them by unimaginably callous employers. Why would their editors encourage such behavior? The simplistic answer they're quick to present again and again is, we are merely supplying the demand for stories like this. Okay, so are these evil men and women scheming in dark tabloid offices about how to cater to the lowest common denominator? Perhaps. But not so obviously, I suspect. They are simply doing nothing to rise above the bad news is good news syndrome. We are a culture fascinated by the rise, and even more so with the decline of famous people. Di's royal wedding was a big deal, sure, but the divorce was even better. And the only thing that could possibly top that was a horrible death. Now that's news. I got an email from a fan recently that cuts to the core of the issue. Email. You know, we fans are really to blame, with our schizophrenic desire to elevate celebrities to godlike status and then tear them down into trembling, pathetic mortals like the rest of us. It's weird. We can't just let them be as gods because deep in the heart of everyone, or Americans at least, is the belief that each of us has just as much right to be a Hollywood stud or starlet, just as beautiful and rich. That's, I think, why Hollywood gossip tabloids do so well, because there we extract our revenge on the icons we create, showing that yes, we still do, or think we do, have power over them. Candace. I thought that was pretty astute, actually. As a 17-year-old kid fresh out of high school, I had my first brush with celebrity as a theater apprentice. There I met a number of, quote, famous people and worked among them for 3 months. Meeting actors in person whom I idolized as a kid was both a thrilling and horrifying experience. More than anything, I was shocked to see that celebrities aged just like normal people. Doug McClure wasn't the strapping man I remembered from his 1960s TV show The Virginian, never mind the fact that the show was 14 years earlier. And Abe Vigoda didn't look anything like his character on Barney Miller. Apart from the disappointment, I was ultimately glad that they were human. The actors I met that summer were talented for the most part, but they also got irritable, forgot their lines, and occasionally farted. All the normal stuff. Turnabout is fair play, as the old saying goes, and I got to experience this recently at a public appearance. As a fan got close to shake my hand, she got a funny look on her face. "Jeez, you look like someone's dad," she said. Well, that's because I am someone's dad. Evil Dead put me at the receiving end of fandom. 6 months after its release, a Ferndale, Michigan cashier squinted at me. "Boy, you look a hell of a lot like Bruce Campbell's brother," he said. "Yeah, that would make a hell of a lot of sense," I replied. Not long after that, I got my first fan letter. I can't recall what it said or how they even found me. But I was thrilled nonetheless and responded with a handwritten note, thanking them for their patronage. As the years passed and I became more identifiable as a genre actor, a steady trickle of letters found their way to me. But The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. opened up the world of mass-market fan mail. The increase in mail wasn't a result of some new acting ability. It was merely because there were more regular viewers. When I looked at the numbers, it all made sense. Even a low-rated TV show like Briscoe snagged more viewers in a single night than all of the Evil Dead films combined. Email. Bruce, I wanted to thank you again for signing my ass at the Cherry Hill Convention. Amy. I've found that the best place to interact with fans is at conventions, my first being a Fangoria Weekend of Horrors event in 1988. In a jammed Los Angeles hotel, I spent 2 days interacting with folks that assumed I was just like the characters I portrayed in films. This resulted in gifts of homegrown poetry that would make your hair curl, requests to sign pierced breasts, and offers to attend all-night Evil Dead drinking games. The same type of thing happened during the run of Briscoe. Because I played a cowboy, letters arrived with offers to buy or sell horses, or to grand marshal parades in rural western towns. The real fun began when the two types of fans converged at some of the larger Briscoe events. A kids' fair in Seattle drew more than kids, and it was amusing to scan the autograph line to see some 10-year-old kid in a cowboy outfit standing in front of a spiked, pierced, leather-clad deadite. Television wins the war of saturation hands down. A motion picture can be shown around the world, but unless it's a blockbuster, it'll be gone from theaters within a month or two. The TV viewer can watch their favorite program week after week, sometimes for a decade or more, and the resulting impact, I feel, is far more indelible. One day, I got a high school graduation tassel in the mail. The young man who sent it explained quite matter-of-factly that the tassel was a gift for me because, were it not for the show Briscoe, he would have killed himself and never graduated. Another note, sent from a despondent fellow, explained that he was about to commit suicide in his crappy Hollywood apartment, but he happened to catch an episode of Briscoe. The positive image of life portrayed by the show caused him to reconsider. Things like this can drive an actor crazy. On the one hand, I'm extremely grateful that a positive message helps someone in need. But on the other hand, what's to keep some kid after watching Evil Dead from slicing up grandma with a chainsaw? The answer, I suppose, is nothing. And that's the frustrating part. Filmmakers and actors all wish to have an impact on the world at large, yet at the same time, we're the first ones to shout, "Hey folks, it's all fake!" As the information age blossomed, my fan mail morphed into email. I found this a much more manageable forum in which to communicate with fans, since no matter where I am in the world, my mailbox is always with me. In case you've ever wondered what fans say to actors, I'll share a few notes, just to demonstrate the variety of sentiments floating around in the great cyber void. Email. Subject: Thanks a mil. Bruce, I just wanted to drop you a note to say thanks. Now, this isn't meant to boost any bloated Hollywood egos or anything. This is an honest-to-God, real-life thank you for making my day a little better. You know how it is, you come home from your crap job after getting belittled for 8 hours for whatever it is you didn't do fast enough with a good round of hour-long traffic on both sides of the equation. Anyway, Friday I got home after a real swell day at the office and I think, gee, what can I do to cheer myself up? Maybe go socialize with actual people? Maybe look on the internet for cheap love? No way, brother. For days that are as bad as that one, the only thing that you can really do is pop in the trusty copy of Evil Dead 2 and see another regular Joe have a really bad day, too. Which is why I wanted to say thanks. After a really crappy day, something that can make you forget it for a while and make you smile is worth a million thanks. Regards, Gerald P. So this first example represents the sincere fans who send pleasant, upbeat letters. About 50% of what I get falls into this category. At the opposite end of the spectrum, there are fans who need 24-hour observation. This next communique is one that I could not stop reading, regardless of how much I wanted to throttle the smug bastard. Email. Bruce, I was pretty amazed to hear you're working on writing a book. I wasn't sure you were literate. Well, I knew you could push the button when you wanted another banana, but real words? This isn't like doing Xena, you know, porn for 12-year-olds. You don't have Lucy Largeass around to show some leg when the plot is lacking its usual depth. I hear a person can drown in 2 inches of water. But Bruce, may I call you Bruce? No? Well, I guess Mr. Huge Fucking Chin will have to do. I wanted to know, do you ever wonder what you could have been with a little bit of talent, or at least more money for bribes? I think we both know the answer to that question, Mr. President. The fan who was like a son to you, Billy. That email is, of course, an extreme example and only represents 1.7% of my total fan mail. Thank God. Emails that fall into remaining categories run the gamut from mildly amusing to quirky to utterly incomprehensible. Regardless of the format, I can speak for most of the actors out there that we are genuinely grateful to anyone who takes the time not only to faithfully follow our work, but to write something that is inherently designed to brighten our day. So once again for that, thank you. Chapter 42, Doing the TV Shuffle. When you've starred in a TV show, even one that's low-rated, an odd chain of events are set in motion. After Briscoe was canceled, I found myself able to travel freely within the realm of television because the credibility checks, once routine, became almost non-existent. Suddenly, roles were simply offered. The first show to welcome me like this was Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. A certain logic prevailed here. This show was also produced by Warner Brothers, and a writer-producer from Briscoe had since defected to this camp. It was a good match of sensibilities, and I managed to slink in and out of three episodes as suave bad guy Bill Church, Jr. On the show, Peter Boyle played my evil father. As a character actor in a number of memorable films such as Taxi Driver and Young Frankenstein, he was no hack. But, like so many other actors in his position, Peter was lured to television. The medium can do odd things to actors, like beat them into submission. Not every actor can spit out lines at the drop of a hat and nail it in one take. Film actors, in particular, don't always enjoy a smooth transition. Peter did one take that should never have been printed on any film set, low budget or not. He stumbled, fumbled, and groped his way through it. I was sure they would have another go at it, but the director glanced at his watch. Great, Peter, he announced. Okay, moving on. Peter looked at me, incredulous. It just doesn't matter, does it? Still, it was fun to work on the familiar Warner backlot, this time dressed in modern garb. As I stood behind the facade of a doorway, waiting for my cue, I glanced at the unpainted plywood. There, written in a black marker, was a note I had scribbled late one night while shooting Briscoe. Briscoe was here, 2/22/94, it stated simply. Sam Raimi got a decidedly twisted TV show of his own up and running called American Gothic. My agent spotted a good guest-starring role, but Sam was hesitant to cast me because the show was, quote, serious. Eventually, it led to a very strange phone call with the Grand Poobah himself. Sam, listen, mister, if I give you this role, you have to be serious. Bruce, well, what did you think I was going to do, wink at the camera the whole time? Well, you know, this isn't like Briscoe, you know. Sam, Briscoe was its own beast. For Christ's sake, I'm an actor. I think I can reach deep into the bowels of my soul and somehow manage to keep a straight face. Besides that, what other actor is going to lie in a coffin and let you pour a box of live cockroaches on their face? Sam, good point. The serious versus funny issue rattled me. My God, I reasoned with myself, I'm not a buffoon. As an actor, I should be able to do anything they throw at me, right? As a result, I vowed to jump at anything dramatic that came my way. One such project was Homicide, Life on the Streets. The first phone call with producer Tom Fontana came as a complete surprise. So, is there anything you'd like to do? He asked, casually. What do you mean? Like, what role would I like to play? Yeah. Gee, can I think about that for a couple days and get back to you? Sure, just give me a call. I was really turned around by this. Actors are usually in the position of begging producers to let them play a certain role. Here was an offer I most certainly could not refuse. In fact, I did have a notion about loopholes in our justice system and pitched Tom a very loose idea several days later. His response further confounded me. Yeah, cool. We'll do a two-parter, he said, as if it happened every day. Within a month, I found myself in Baltimore shooting a strikingly similar story. The writers created a fine character, a police officer faced with a moral dilemma of whether or not to take justice into his own hands. Creatively, the experience was as close to perfection as I could have hoped for. Other TV gigs materialized out of thin air. I got a call one morning to see if I could drop by the Disney lot and meet with Ellen DeGeneres and her producers about a role during their lunch break. The meeting was only a few minutes long, and after a quick, closed-door huddle, I was invited to read a few scenes with Ellen and the director, Gil. The thrust of this session was really to make sure I could handle the snappy pace of sitcoms, something I had not yet done. I guess now it was an issue of whether I could be funny enough. After another closed-door meeting, the casting agent approached me with an almost apologetic look on her face. Bruce, what are you doing for the rest of the day? Nothing in particular, why? Well, we need you to go into rehearsals right now. I walked over to the stage, hastily introduced myself to the other cast members, and got to work. This was a Wednesday afternoon. The show was taped on Friday, and voila, I was a sitcom actor. The undefined commitment on Ellen eventually blossomed into 8 episodes, and it was a pleasure to learn a new side to my craft. Sitcoms are a freaky atmosphere. The entire week of rehearsal is spent trying to maximize the humor in every scene. To do this, the writing staff engaged in the most extensive script changes I'd ever witnessed. The script from Monday's read-through would almost invariably be completely rewritten overnight, and Tuesday's rewrite wound up on my doorstep Wednesday morning. When do these poor bastards sleep? I'd ask myself. By Thursday, the script was usually beaten into shape and the technical stuff would take control. Friday night, a studio audience was recruited, as well as a comedian to keep them up during scene changes. It was a lot of fun to watch Ellen, by this time an expert at the medium, work her way through a show. If the first take went well, she'd riff on the second take, tossing in a few curves, to delight both the cast and the viewing audience. I was glad to be a part of the last Out episode. My character, Ed Billick, a right-wing kind of guy, was the dissenting voice in Ellen's journey to an openly gay network character. Much to her credit, this was Ellen's idea, and it made for some good drama in the middle of an otherwise funny show. Another abstract notion sprang from my new TV status, the development deal. This is a relationship formed between an actor or writer, etc., and a production company and or TV network, whereby they pay you not to work for anyone else while a mutually agreeable concept for a new show is developed. Following Briscoe, I engaged in several such deals. Meetings were first on the agenda, dozens of meetings. Notions were kicked around with executives to make sure we were all on the same page, and we'd try like hell to define the type of show, its format, and a rough time slot. Once this was hashed out, I spent the next several months meeting with what seemed to be every TV writer in Southern California to hear their pitches. Joe Ryder. Well, it's kind of like the Rockford Files meets Land of the Giants. Bruce, gee, an incomprehensible blend of two shows from 20 years ago. Yeah, that ought to knock 'em dead. Jeff Ryder. See, you're an ambulance-chasing lawyer, and it's all about your private life. Bruce, let me get this straight. We're supposed to like this guy? Jane Ryder. Get this. You're a gym teacher by day and an international spy by night. Bruce. Excuse me, I think I'm double-parked. Eventually, the ideas all blended into a mishmash of baloney. More times than not, a show never gets on the air, but sometimes you get close. A development deal with ABC led to a sitcom pilot called Missing Links. The concept was based on a successful book, and it operated in a world that I enjoyed. If I were pitching it to myself, I would explain it as Cheers at a low-rent public golf course. The pilot went over very well with our live audience, and it was one of the highest-rated sitcoms in their testing process that year. But ABC didn't have a slot for it. This was a heartbreaker, and I'd be a liar if I said this experience didn't take a bit of the wind out of my sails. Christ, am I just killing myself for no good reason? People often wonder why some actors fall off the face of the earth for no apparent reason. I got news for you. There is always a reason, and frustration with the business is a huge factor. Chapter 43. X marks the spot. The great wheel turns. Email. Saw your X-Files appearance last night. Can I say I've never seen more color and texture in your performance? It's nice to see you're expanding your horizons a bit beyond leading man wink at the camera camp bit. It works for you, but it's nice to see you act from time to time. Yours, Jeremy. When most people think of the X-Files, they think of paranoia, mystery, and science fiction. I think of farts. David Duchovny, known for his sober performances on screen, was actually a funny guy. One night on set, he got his hands on a fart cup, you know, those plastic cups filled with a gooey substance, and he couldn't put it down. Eventually, we got into something of a farting contest to see who could simulate the best potato chip fart, which was fast and dry, or the raunchiest taco fart, which was slow and wet. We called it a draw when the crew couldn't handle it anymore. Appearing on The X-Files was an interesting experience for several reasons. It marked not only a return to the Fox network, but a chance to join up with the show that Briscoe preceded, seemingly 100 years ago. Several Briscoe directors went on to get involved with The X-Files, and my former makeup man, Kevin Westmore, was on board, so it had the feeling of coming home again. I had met David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson doing promotion for our respective shows years before. David and I shared a plane flight to a sales event in Chicago. At that point, He wasn't the TV veteran he is today, and he leaned over to me during the flight.
David, what the hell are we supposed to do with these promo things?
Bruce, what do you mean?
Well, like, are we supposed to be funny or charming or what?
A little of both, I guess. I think we're there just to press the flesh.
I feel like such a jerk.
Hey, be glad you don't have to walk around dressed like a cowboy.
Gillian Anderson and I met co-presenting an award to some TV sales guy. I didn't take the event too seriously and wore a cowboy hat with my tux. The script they wrote for us was awful, like they usually are at award shows, so I tried to con her into doing some old routines.
Hey, Gillian, let's do one of those 10-gallon hat gags, you know? What do you say?
Gillian, why would I want to do that?
Well, this isn't exactly the Oscars, you know. I thought we could have some fun with it.
You can do what you like. I'm going to read my copy and get out of here.
You know, I realized after the fact, she must have thought I was an alien. That's it.
Chapter 44, Quest for the Holy Grail, Grabbing at Phantoms. Fame, a definition. 1. Public estimation, reputation. B. Popular acclaim, renown. Recently, while responding to email online, I got an instant message from a fan.
Bruce, how do I become a famous actor?
Bruce, when I'm famous, I'll let you know.
Seriously, how can I?
Shoot a president.
What?
Do you want to be famous, or do you want to be an actor? They are two completely different things.
Technically, to qualify as an actor, you could stand in your living room and recite the phone book to your cat. If you want to be a movie star, that's a whole new game with its own set of rules. A movie star can't just be an actor, because in the truest sense of the word, an actor can be a man or a woman, old, young, overweight, balding, and unremarkable, and it wouldn't really matter, as long as they could act. A movie star, conversely, doesn't have to be that good of an actor, or even master the English language, as long as they possess qualities that separate them from the herd. Some movie stars, and I'm using this obnoxious term only because it's so familiar, get by on sheer charisma, that great indefinable thing, or an astounding physique. But more often, it's a combination of pleasing physical characteristics, a basic acting ability, and a hell of a lot of drive. Actors who aspire to rise above the level of community theater, local commercials, or a syndicated TV show must apply themselves on a multitude of levels. The first thing they must do is look like a movie star. If you're out of shape, well, you better renew that lapsed gym membership. Teeth too yellow or crooked? No sweat. A trip to the local cosmetic dentist can fix that. If you wear glasses, just run down to the optometrist and get those contacts. Or, better still, get laser surgery to, quote, permanently solve the defect. While you're on the laser kick, maybe it's time to clean up some of those scars, warts, and blemishes that have been haunting you for years. God forbid that movie stars should look like the rest of us. Personally, I've always been amused by the fact that some of Hollywood's most renowned tough guys, such as Bogart, John Wayne, and Burt Reynolds, all wore toupees. Alan Ladd, a leading man in the 40s and 50s, was cast opposite short starlets to mask his own diminutive stature. Ronald Reagan wore glasses. Clark Gable had smelly dentures and pinned his large ears back. I'll tell you, all actors should be grateful for the day when Sean Connery, one of the manliest men of the silver screen, removed his toupee for all the world to see. Even with all the efforts actors go through to perfect their bodies, it's nothing compared to what they do to be discovered. When not at the gym or tanning salon, actors are networking, and Hollywood parties are an obvious starting point. I saved a phone message from an ex-Michigan friend after he had been in Los Angeles for a couple years.
Bruce, hey, this is Nathan. Listen, I'm having a party this weekend and I'd like you to come.
Now in Michigan, the message would have ended there, but not in Sporville, USA. It continued.
Hey, we got some great people coming, some really great people.
Nathan proceeded to name the luminaries he had, quote, confirmed, as if I had to be sold on the concept. I didn't go, and it wasn't because his party wasn't good enough. It was because he never once mentioned that it might actually be fun. By the time I tried to be a movie star, I had already been an actor in about 15 films. More than anything, I was curious to find out how hard it would be to punch through the glass ceiling of film grades and exchange my B-grade status for a big, shiny A. Jeffrey Bohm was one of the executive producers of The Adventures of Briscoe County, Jr. He also had a day job as a big-shot Hollywood writer who participated in the Indiana Jones and Lethal Weapons series, among others. His latest project for Paramount Pictures was a film adaptation of the pulp fiction hero The Phantom, and he contacted me about the possibility of playing the lead role. With the help of my manager, we began the journey on foot to see what we could see. Our first meeting was with the designated director, Joe Dante. He was bright and pleasant enough, and we enjoyed a spirited conversation, but Joe wasn't where the buck stopped to get this role, not by a country mile. This was evidenced by the fact that he didn't even wind up directing the film. Next on the list were the Paramount executives in charge of the film. These meetings were always short and produced little in the way of conversation, largely since actors and executives don't have that much to say to each other. Executive: "So, Bruce, you, like the project?" Bruce: Yep, sure do. Looks like a lot of fun." Yeah, we're really excited about it." Bruce: "I can understand that. Looks like a lot of fun." Didn't I already say that? Meetings like that are more about executives looking you over to make sure you have all your limbs and can string a full sentence together. The real test was to make an impression on the film's legendary producer, Robert Evans. A fixture at Paramount since the 70s, this once powerful man was behind classics like Chinatown and Marathon Man. To catch his interest, I had to come up with an icebreaker, some sort of conversation starter. I dug through a Who's Who in Hollywood book and found out that he was once, like me, an actor. Rumor had it he had been handpicked by actress Norma Shearer to play legendary producer Irving Thalberg in the Lon Chaney biography Man of a Thousand Faces. That's obscure enough, I figured. Robert Evans' face lit up the moment I mentioned this film from 40 years ago. He waxed nostalgic for a brief moment, and it seemed to relax the atmosphere in an otherwise tense room. Ironically, the last person I met with was the casting director, someone who, under normal circumstances, I would have met with first. As an actor, the ability to do an end run around someone who has the power to stop your forward momentum is a huge victory. I must admit, I was undeniably cocky by the time I sat with her. The next and last phase of this campaign was the screen test. My manager got his hands on the number of the actress who would play opposite me. Normally, I wasn't expected or even advised to contact her, but nothing about this was normal, so I gave her a call and weaseled my way into rehearsing. No studio in their right mind would screen test just one actor, so in my case, it boiled down to two people, me and Billy Zane. Since the desire was to create a franchise out of this character, the project must have gone to every bankable hero type in town, but for whatever reason, Billy and I wound up on the ticket. Like the network test I had to do for Briscoe, a contract had to be negotiated in advance. This grueling phase didn't take long, but the trick was to dig up every contract I had ever signed and find every perk I had ever received. Negotiating with the studio's business affairs department, aka lawyers, wasn't that big of a deal as long as you could prove that you had already gotten everything you were asking for at some point in your career. Finally, the schmoozing and strategy ended, and I found myself on the Paramount lot. I signed my contract in a makeup bungalow and walked onto stage 21 to face the one-eyed monster. The shoot itself only took a couple hours, and I left without fanfare. Waiting for that big call is where you second-guess yourself to death and play all of the woulda, shoulda, coulda games over and over. I had two choices: wait by the phone and be tormented by every ring, or get as far away from it as I could. I chose the latter and wandered the hills behind my house in Southern California until the big verdict came down about 36 hours later. Paramount had found their man, and it was Billy Zane. Do not pass go. Do not collect $100. I was surprised at how well I took the news. It was more of a relief than anything because I was tired of all the games I had to play to get that far. To quote Rocky, I went the distance, and it was good enough for me. Chapter 45. The higher the budget, the lower the part. Email: Dear Mr. Campbell, I can't understand why you don't get involved in a commercial film where we can enjoy your talents. I love your work and only see you in oddball movies. I can't believe we watched Mind Warp. Can't you do something, well, normal? Very truly yours, Janet. The Phantom proved indelibly that I was not in a position to barge into Acme Studios and insist that they offer up a fat role in their next summer blockbuster. It seemed that my lot in life was to either have big parts in small films or small parts in big films. I do work in the realm of fantasy, but I haven't lost touch with reality. This became evident with the film Congo. I met with director Frank Marshall to con him into giving me the lead role, ultimately played by Dylan Walsh. I did my best to sell Frank on the fact that I was the guy for the job, the right one to sweat with him in the jungle. Frank was unconvinced, but kindly offered up the small, dead-in-5 minutes role of Charles. Sometimes Hollywood is like a game show. If you don't win the brand new car, you get a toaster. I mean, who was I to argue with the man who used to produce all of Steven Spielberg's films? Where do I sign? There was a distinct advantage to being a small cog in a very big wheel. And Congo was one of those situations where it was almost impossible to complain about being an actor. The amount of days it took to film my character was of little concern to a company that had to deal with issues like airlifting tons of film equipment to the base of one of the most active volcanoes in the world. Standing at the base of the Arenal volcano with Frank Marshall, I joked that maybe next time he could find a place a little more remote. "This is nothing," he stated plainly. "Try and get catering in the Sahara Desert." He was referring to a Spielberg epic he produced, and I could tell that he wasn't joking. In the film, my character leads an ill-fated expedition deep into the bowels of the Congo. A second expedition, with principal actors, passed through the same areas but had to stop and confront some challenge every step along the way. On a practical level, this meant that shooting the first expedition only required a couple of shots in each location, while the second team invariably filmed for days on end. So, for the actors in this first expedition, an excellent scam presented itself. Call sheets were posted outside the hotel production office at 5 p.m. every day. If the word hold appeared next to our name, it meant that we weren't needed the next day, and we'd race over to a travel agent, open until 7, and book an excursion. I'm only half guilty to announce that, compliments of Paramount Pictures, I whitewater rafted, body surfed on pristine beaches, and tramped through nameless jungle tracks surrounded by 5,000-year-old trees. Thanks, Gulf and Western. I often get hassled by fans about why I did that film. The thing that many folks don't understand is that an actor doesn't always do things for art. I would have paid to go to Costa Rica, and yet I had a chance to not only go there for free, but get paid as well. Escape from L.A. was familiar terrain, and it was a chance to work with John Carpenter, whose film Halloween convinced us that the horror genre would be a viable choice for our first film. In the 2 days that I worked on Escape, John only gave me one piece of direction. In a very friendly but direct way, he lowered his voice and said, "Bruce, I want this dead straight." He must have been in collusion with Sam Raimi. The real plus of playing the Surgeon General of Beverly Hills was working with one of the best special effects makeup guys in the business, Rick Baker. Because my role was that of a twisted freak, Rick patterned the look after the more celebrated plastic surgery mistakes in Hollywood. The character wound up with a tight, ski-slope nose, an obvious facelift, some collagen implants, movie star teeth, plucked eyebrows, and hair plugs, not unlike a Ken doll. The results were subtle yet alarming and took 5 hours to complete. The other cool thing about working on big-budget films is that you do go toe-to-toe with big-shot actors, Kurt Russell in this case. I always had a lot of respect for Kurt. He had been around a long time, and I recalled seeing him in episodes of Lost in Space and even Gilligan's Island when I was a kid. It was nice to see him finally get his due as a big buck leading man. I went to the set in preparation for my scene with Kurt, and I spotted him casually chatting off in the corner. He was acting like he had just dropped by the set to see what was going on and happened to wind up in the film. When I introduced myself, he got a kick out of my makeup, but he was interested in something else. Kurt, "Hey, Bruce, see work shit." Bruce, incredulous, "What?" "Yeah, from Evil Dead 2. Yeah, I know that, but how do you know that obscure line?" "Oh, my son's a big fan of that film. For some reason, he wanted me to have you say it." Kurt was too polite to mention that work shed was an obvious overdub to help audiences know where my character Ash was going next. If you watch the film, my mouth doesn't move at all during that line, and it's a point of great ridicule on college campuses around the country. Sometimes an actor takes a role because he or she thinks it will advance their career. Other times, it will be to fulfill an artistic longing or to simply make a big payday. McHale's Navy would fall into the none-of-the-above category. One day I got a call from my manager. "Robert, Bruce, something's come together that's really exciting." "Bruce, oh cool, what is it?" It's a supporting role for Universal.
Ah, cool. What is it?
Brian Spicer, you know who did the Briscoe pilot, is going to direct it.
Cool, but like I said, what is it?
McHale's Navy.
Oh, the old TV show. They're going to remake it.
Yes, there's a part Brian wants you to play.
Oh? Who?
His name is Virgil, one of the sailors. This part is really something you could have fun with. I'll send you the script.
When any script arrives, I always do a simple test to see how much dialogue my character has. I flip through the pages like I'm shuffling a deck of cards and try and spot the character's name in dialogue scenes. If it's easy to spot as I whiz along, it means that I have a lot of dialogue, and it's often a big role. When I finished the test for McHale's Navy, I was surprised to note that I never spotted the name Virgil. Ah, must have missed a few pages, I thought. Better try this again. I leafed through the pages more slowly this time and caught a fleeting glimpse of Virgil early in the script before the name disappeared from the radar screen entirely. Finally, I sat down and read the full script. From an actor's point of view, the warning signs were everywhere. McHale and his men search the area. McHale and his crew go to Cuba. McHale and the others get off the boat. The translation of that meant that I'd have many days with nothing specific to do. I recall a brief conversation with Liam Neeson while he was looping Darkman. Hey, Liam, I caught the end of the bounty the other day, and I could have sworn that was you.
Oh, yes, it was.
Well, who are you?
I played the guy over Mel Gibson's left shoulder.
Oh, what do you mean?
Well, I was one of the sailors. My big challenge each day was to see which of Mel's shoulders I would get behind. Usually, I wound up behind the left one.
With these omens, I called my manager in search of a logical reason why I should be in this film. Robert, I just read the script.
Funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a laugh riot, but there's only one problem.
Oh?
My character doesn't do anything.
Well, they're going through a major rewrite right now, and Brian has some big plans for beefing up all the sailor parts.
Do you really think anything's going to change?
Yes, I do. I think we should do this.
My manager always used the royal we, when it's really me who's going to do the work. The reality of motion pictures is that the screenplay writer will concentrate their effort on the largest three or four characters, showering them with finely honed dialogue, endearing character traits, and a full dramatic arc. When you're lower on the screen time food chain, you get what falls from the table. McHale's Navy was all about table scraps. I decided to at least do the basic actor prep stuff, find out what I can about this thing called the Navy. I had my trusty assistant, Craig, drive a few hours south of L.A. to pick up a copy of the Blue Jackets Manual, the official training manual of the United States Navy. Anthony Hopkins, eat your method heart out. Upon delivery of this Navy Bible, I sat with highlighter in hand, marking anything interesting, pertinent, or quirky. There were heaps of useless tidbits, but at first glance, there was no practical use for them in the film. After rereading the script, I noticed a scene where McHale's crew stages a telethon to jam the radio signals of the bad guy played by Tim Curry. The only thing the script actually specified, however, was that Virgil, quote, jammed on the drums. Well, I had no idea how to play drums, so I hastily arranged lessons with a man at his house in the San Fernando Valley. My sweaty, shirtless teacher led me to his ratty drum set.
Okay, Junior, let's see your stuff.
I showed him what I knew about playing drums, which didn't take long, and he walked me through a couple of basic drum exercises. After 10 minutes, he rolled his eyes and grabbed my sticks.
You will never be a drummer, he stated flatly. Give me the check.
Despite the knowledge imparted by this gifted teacher, it was ultimately decided on location that there would be no band. Instead, a talent show was devised for the climax of the film, but there wasn't any description beyond Virgil and Happy, played by French Stewart, are on stage performing. I knew I was on my own, and I sure as hell didn't want to be caught improvising something at the last minute on set, so I dug up that Navy manual and came upon a passable angle. Nautical terms like poop deck, bullnose, and breastline seemed to cry out for some kind of vaudevillian bit. I called up Gagmeister pal Ron One-Liner Zwang and invited him over for a brainstorming session in my backyard. Together we hashed out a seaworthy version of the classic Abbott and Costello routine, Who's On First?, and renamed it Who's On Deck? On location in Mexico, before the talent show was filmed, I approached my fellow Navy co-star French Stewart of Third Rock from the Sun fame. Hey, French, I was thinking about this talent show.
Yeah, we're on stage together. What's up with that? What are we supposed to do?
I have no idea. I'm afraid we're going to have our thumbs up our asses.
Yeah, no shit. Got any ideas?
I sold French on the new routine, and we pitched it to director Brian Spicer to get him on board. Brian appreciated our efforts, but we had to get it past star and co-producer Tom Arnold as well. French and I ran it up his flagpole, and he gave us the nod. Armed with the approval of the director and co-producer, I approached the costume designer and asked him to scare up an officer's uniform like the one worn by Captain Binghamton, played by veteran Dean Stockwell. Operation Screen Time was complete. The only thing to do now was shoot the sucker. In the completed film, French and I wound up out of focus over Tom's left shoulder for the duration of our little act. Well, you gotta try, right? In case you're interested, here is the routine in its entirety. Note, the setting is my character Virgil, imitating Captain Binghamton, Bingy, as he indoctrinates a young recruit, played by French. Who's on deck?
Bingy. Sailor, let me see your duty roster. Did you clean the mess deck?
No, sir.
Why not?
Well, say I spent 12 hours a day cleaning the mess deck from top to bottom. What would it be?
The mess deck.
Right. So why bother?
Where is your dinghy, sailor?
Where it always is, sir.
Is it tied off to the masthead?
Oh, no, that was just a one-time hazing prank, sir.
Has your dinghy been shellacked?
Don't ask, don't tell.
Did you hook up the bending shackle to her breast line?
Oh, I tried, sir, believe me.
And you had a good grip on your jackstaff?
Oh, like my life depended on it, sir.
Where was your chafing gear?
Oh, definitely broadside, sir.
I'm assuming you tightened up the ram tensioner.
Well, sure, a guy's got to pace himself.
What about the ground tackle?
Oh, I don't go in for that rough stuff, sir.
Did you hold her forward, double up, and heave?
Well, we never got to heaving.
I hope you took liberty,
haha, every chance I got.
Are you prepared for launch, sailor?
Yes, sir. I had a light breakfast.
You, sailor, are an idiot.
Yeah, but I'm not as big of an idiot as I used to be.
How is that possible?
I lost weight.
McHale's Navy forced the sailors of Tom Arnold's crew to become method actors. Each day we had to concoct dialogue for ourselves. Some days it was easy, and other days it was like pulling teeth. Brian Haley, a unique stand-up comic, was great at coming up with gags, but sometimes they were too elaborate for his own good. I first met him on the flight down to Mexico, and for some reason, we enjoyed tormenting each other immediately. Brian had been in the film Baby's Day Out, a bomb in the States but a big hit in places like Mexico, where it was known as Bebe Suerto. The airline stewardess recognized Haley and made a fuss about how famous he was. Brian, always at the ready, produced an 8x10 photo.
Hey, Bruce, you see that? She wants my autograph. I'm not so good at Spanish. What should I write on it?
How about best wishes, Señor Cojones?
What does that mean?
It means you're a strong man.
Oh, that's perfect. Thanks, pal.
Haley proudly scribbled it on the picture and handed it to the stewardess, who immediately giggled and showed it to her coworkers.
Hey, they like it.
Yeah, they seem to get a real kick out of it, Brian.
Haley wasn't so pleased when he found out what it really meant. Testicles.
God damn it, Campbell, I'm going to kill you. I can't believe you let me write that on that lady's picture.
Look, get used to it, Haley. This is going to be a long, hot summer. We're going to need all the gags we can come up with down there. The next gag was on me, at the Manzanillo Customs Office. The system in place was supposedly impartial. Each passenger pushed a button near the exit of customs and activated a light. If it was green, they could pass without question. But if the light was red, they were subject to having their bags searched. As I approached the button, a customs officer waved a hand at me.
Un momento, por favor, señor.
Other passengers filed in front of me, and each time I attempted to push the impartial button, the customs officer gave me the same line until everybody exited before me. Maybe it was the 7 shipping cases that tipped off the customs officers, but it became very clear that I was not going to get a green light under any circumstances. Soon the other actors became aware of what was unfolding and began to crowd around the exit. Haley led a chant,
"Red light! Red light! Red light!"
The customs officer finally gestured to me and I pushed the button. I don't think a single person in the building was surprised to see the light flash red and the actors erupted in a cheer. "Yeah, laugh it up, assholes," I said, producing a stack of paperwork. Fortunately for the payoff of the gag, I had heard tales of questionable Mexican customs and had taken every precaution to defend myself. I tend to take my life with me on the road, so I had unusual travel items in my bags. To head off potential problems, I generated lists of everything I brought, complete with a make, model, and serial number. In addition, I got a letter from a, quote, Hollywood doctor, explaining why I needed particular food items like turkey jerky and dried mango, then translated everything into Spanish. It was a scam of major proportions, but I figured, hey, why not fight fire with fire? Eventually, by the third shipping case, the customs official threw up his hands and waved me through. The crowd of jeering actors parted as I stepped through. Yeah, who's laughing now, funny man, I winked. See if you get some turkey jerky later. Gags were the only thing that got us through the three-month schedule. Haley would often come up with what we coined the Haley button, the final gag in a scene. In many cases, it was a good ender, like the protein powder choke or the ventriloquist dummy made out of coconuts. But Haley was also prone to overachieving. One scene required all the sailors to perform manual labor on the base. I was content to slowly paint a fence in the background, but Haley insisted on an elaborate gag. Brian, okay, get this. Looks like I'm wearing a T-shirt, but it's really just painted on. Gee, Brian, that sounds like a pain in the ass to me. No, it'll be great. That's what my character would do. Okay, but how will the audience know? Well, they won't, but it doesn't matter. Hey, Brian, knock yourself out. My favorite image that day was Haley, slumped over at lunch, realizing that he had to be covered with latex paint all day in 100-degree weather. It's the role, stupid. Actors make decisions all the time, and some are abysmally bad. On many occasions, I've taken a part because it was the only thing available and was grateful for the work. But after being in a string of stinkers, I decided that some discretion was advised. This has had uneven results career-wise, but for me, it was all about peace of mind. I put my new theory to the test when I got a script that could be described as Die Hard on a space station. Hardly original, but it intrigued me enough to consider the part of the Bruce Willis-type hero.